The next case on calendar this morning is case number 63683, In Re Lamont A.W., a minor. We have Jennifer Fraser as counsel for the appellant and Daniel Westmeyer as counsel for the respondent. Ms. Fraser, are you ready to proceed?
I am, Your Honor.
Please tell us how much time you want to reserve for rebuttal.
Your Honor, if I could reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
I said at the outset of the other argument, I don't know if counsel was present. Justice Perigary will participate in the disposition of this by listening to the tape. He was unavoidably absent today.
Okay, thank you. Good morning, and may it please the court. I'm Jennifer Fraser, Deputy Public Defender, representing the appellant Lamont W. The Fourth Amendment protects people, including juveniles, to be free from unreasonable searches of his or her belongings and person, the fundamental right to be free from arbitrary invasions by government officials. Here, the juvenile court erred when it admitted evidence against Lamont, which was discovered during a random search of his person as well as his backpack. This random search was not based on any reasonable suspicion, which is required under TLO. TLO is a U.S. Supreme Court case which ruled that students at school have a legitimate expectation of privacy. The search must be reasonable under a totality of circumstances. The court must undergo a two-step analysis. First, whether the search was justified at its inception, and second, whether the search was reasonably related in the scope to circumstances which initially justified the search. Here, the state must concede that there was no reasonable suspicion, thus the search was unconstitutional and unreasonable. The state argues, and ultimately the lower court agreed, that the behavior contract, which is page 49 of the appendix for Legacy High School, was a consensual waiver of Lamont's Fourth Amendment rights. This purported contract is an attempt by the school district to circumvent the Fourth Amendment and juveniles' legitimate expectations of privacy granted by TRO. The contract was signed November 8th of 2012, and the instant offense occurred January 31st of 2013, so that was just shy of 3 months. Of course, consent is a recognized exception to the warrant requirements of state and federal constitutions. Yes, the juvenile can consent to a search, but the analysis does not end there. The consent must be voluntary. Under Bustamante, a U.S. Supreme Court case, the government bears the burden of proving consent was voluntary. Here, in the lower court, the juvenile court, there was no actual evidentiary hearing with regard to the motion to suppress, nor was there ever any testimony presented during the contested hearing to explain the circumstances of Lamont signing the behavior contract to go back to regular school and to go to Legacy High School. In the state's responding brief, they heavily rely on State v. Stevens, which is an Oregon Supreme Court case, which considered a very similar situation to the case at hand. In that case, the court held that the juvenile voluntarily consented to random searches by signing an agreement that at first blush seems somewhat similar to the situation here. In that case, the 17-year-old was at an alternative school. It was a voluntary program, and I think that was the main distinction between that case and what we have here. It was a turnaround school which allowed students to remove expulsion from their records if they successfully completed, and I think that was the benefit of the so-called bargain of signing up on this agreement. Also in that Oregon school, the court noted that it was an at-risk student body, so there was a heightened level of security and supervision at the school. All of the children had to keep their items in lockers at all times. Anytime they went to their lockers, it was supervised. They had to be patted down as well as go through a metal detector. Administrators could conduct random searches at any times. Students were even escorted everywhere, including classrooms and bathrooms. None of those conditions were present in this case. It's not the condition of school at Legacy High School. In fact, Legacy is a regular school. We're not talking about an opportunity school or an alternative program. In our case, and I think that speaks to Lamont's knowledge and therefore the voluntariness of what he was actually consenting to. There were significant differences between the facts of Oregon and here. In that case, the school officials sat down with the student and the parent and explained all of the rules, all of the school, and the extent of the searches. Again, that goes back to the voluntariness and also the scope of the consent. The court relied on the fact that school officials were both, were, quote, fully informed, both youth and his mother, about the school's conditions and his choices. And those are simply things that didn't happen in this case. We don't have any testimony or any information of what school officials talked to Lamont about or to let him know that this was a voluntary program and he didn't have to go to trial enrollment at Legacy. And I know that the lower court relies on the fact that it was voluntary because he's 17, he had other options, and even pointed out that the argument may have been stronger had Lamont been under 17. The 17 is important because that's the age where a child can sign up for adult education, but a child younger doesn't have those same options, and presumably children younger than Lamont at 17 were asked to sign such a document. Here, Lamont's consent was not voluntary because he had, or the state argues Lamont's consent was voluntary because he had options, specifically the adult education. However, the state's asking the court to adopt as policy the constitutionality of this form for all CCSD students, because this wasn't a form just typed up from Lamont. And I think,
but we're focused on Lamont's case here.
Of course. And as specifically to Lamont and the form, there's no language in the actual behavior contract about its voluntariness, of whether he was informed that he didn't have to go to this school, he didn't have to go into the trial enrollment, and that there wasn't even the benefit, like in Oregon, of him being able to get rid of an expulsion on his record. And this seems to be a completely one-sided arrangement with the school drafting this and not having any other information about the scope. And that leads me to the next issue. In addition to the voluntariness, there also has to be objective, reasonably scope of the consent. And that's under Florida v. Jimeno. The behavior contract here is overly broad and doesn't pass constitutional muster. With regard to this contract, it purportedly justifies any search at any time for an indefinite amount of time. There's no ending time period of when this consent lasts. It's not specific enough. There's no discussion about client's ability to rescind the contract or client's ability to limit the consent at the time he signed it or at any future time and date. And certainly this court knows with regard to when a person gives consent for a search, during that search, at any time, that person can limit that. And here there was no information about whether Lamont was made aware of that. There's nothing objectively reasonable about a student giving administrators essentially carte blanche authority to search him anytime the school wants to without any reasonable suspicion. And under Fourth Amendment jurisprudence, it's always a question of reasonableness. And I would submit that this behavior contract certainly is not. In Stevens, it was objectively reasonable because of the information we know about the school and the heightened level of the structure and security at that school, which is not present in this case. And also, this court has noted in other contexts as well that Nevada law has embraced a more expansive interpretation of constitutional rights than federal law, and I think that the court can do that here because the issues presented are important enough for those same considerations.
Can I pick up a question for a moment and ask a question? Am I misinterpreting the facts? Because it seems to me that I read that your client actually said the word okay in response to a request to search. Isn't that a voluntary consent?
I don't believe, as part of the record of the testimony, that he was asked if he was going to consent to search. I think that the school teacher, the teacher is the person who conducted the search when he went up to Lamont and said, I'm going to search you, and removed him out of the class. So he said okay to that. I don't think that was a consent to the search.
So the record at page 73 must be wrong, where the teacher says, we are going to search, and Lamont says, okay.
Right. I don't think that his statement of okay is a consent to the search. Is my argument. I think he's just acknowledging that, okay, you're going to search me. I don't think that he was never asked, there was never a separate question at that time, are you consenting to this search today?
Okay.
So that would be my position. There's also an issue or a sub-issue that I addressed in my opening brief and reply brief as far as administrative searches and special needs exceptions, which do come up with school searches. I know that the lower court relied on the consent issue, but as far as administrative searches and the special needs exception, there are several Supreme Court cases, U.S. Supreme Court cases, that have to do with schools and a child's lessened expectation of privacy because they're voluntarily signed up for sports in school, for extracurricular activities. And I think the main distinction between those cases and the cases present and the case present this morning is the fact that the court specifically said that any evidence found of wrongdoing was not then referred to criminal investigation or for a criminal investigatory purpose. Those things were handled in-house and within the school, and I think that was the distinction for the court, always with Fourth Amendment and reasonableness, especially with regard to special needs exception, doing a balancing test between a child's right to privacy and then the level of intrusion. So because those cases then weren't referred on to criminal prosecution, those are analogous to the incident here. The second issue with regard to this case is the sufficiency of evidence, and we submit that there was insufficient evidence submitted at the trial with regard to the green leafy substance. At the contested hearing, the police officer, school police officer, conducted a field test of the green leafy substance. The field test was positive for marijuana, but there was no further testing. The officer never sent the green leafy substance to the crime lab for testing, and there was no expert witness testimony presented to properly identify what this green leafy substance was, what the chemical makeup of this was. Certainly a field test, which is what was conducted and which what was admitted into evidence, is sufficient for a probable cause finding, but not for proof beyond a reasonable doubt. There are several cases that this court has found that a field test is okay for the level of evidence at a preliminary hearing, but certainly not for a trial. Bolden v. Sheriff discussed that a trial's proof is usually supplied through an expert witness. with regard to Byron, this Lamont's purported identification of the green leafy substance would be enough for PC at the preliminary hearing, but again, not to sustain an adjudication. And when this was argued at the juvenile court judge seemed to have grave concerns about this lack of evidence presented at the contested hearing, referencing protocol lawyers are trained to prove every day when a drug is a drug. He talked about how it's abnormal to have impounded evidence not brought to trial, and he was uncomfortable relying on lay witness testimony, the teacher, about identification of the green leafy substance, and the teacher in fact testified that he's not a drug expert. The substance could have been spice, a synthetic marijuana, which is what the court pointed out, and all of these concerns individually, but certainly collectively, are reasonable doubt to show what, is reasonable doubt of what this green leafy substance was. And secondly, with regard to the for purpose of sale under NRS 453337, this court has not explicitly ruled as to what does or does not constitute sufficient evidence for the purpose of sale element of that statute. But when looking at federal case law, cases have discussed the case of small bags, a scale, a pay and owe sheet, and that all of these items collectively, not individually, can prove for purpose of sale. That was a Ninth Circuit case that talked about that, U.S. v. Johnson, and another Ninth Circuit case talks about where the state can rely on expert testimony for an officer to testify about the amount of drugs found being beyond what is reasonable for personal use. And in that case, there were over 500 grams of drugs. Here, there was no contraband found. We have 2.2 grams of marijuana, no scale, no pay and owe sheet or ledger, no expert testimony about what would be consistent with that of a seller, and certainly Lamont denied selling. So I would submit that the lower court erred in finding sufficiency of evidence with regard to identification of the green leafy substance and for purpose of sale.
Very well. You have 1 minute and 27 seconds remaining.
Thank you.
Morning. May it please the court. My name is Daniel Westmeyer. I'm a deputy district attorney in the Clark County District Attorney's Office. I represent the state of Nevada, the respondent in this case. The appellant raises two issues in this case, and I want to discuss both of them. But first, but it's something I want to bring to the court's attention regarding the timing of this case. The notice of appeal in this case was filed 11 days before the appellant's 18th birthday. At the time the briefs were filed, the appellant was on juvenile probation as a result of this case. However, since that time, the appellant has since completed his probation. He is now 19 and a half years old. He turns 20 in July. At this point, he had the jurisdiction of the juvenile court expired, and as such, there is no longer a case or controversy here. This case has, since the filing of the notice of appeal, become moot. I wanted to raise that for the court's attention. That wasn't raised in the briefs because at the time the briefs were written, the case was not moot. It has since become moot. Regarding the search.
And have you filed any motion or anything in writing that would inform our analysis of that?
I haven't yet. I wanted to get some guidance from the court on how the court wanted us to handle that. If the court wants us to file a motion to dismiss based on mootness, we'll be happy to do that. But
we're generally not equipped to just take things up.
Of course.
Orally at argument that suggests a problem with our jurisdiction. So if you wish to bring it in, I'm not saying that it's timely or appropriate, you need to file a motion in writing supported by something in the record.
And we'll do that, but I wanted to make the court aware of that.
Yeah, thank you.
As to the two issues, the first is the search issue. And again, the issue of the consent search. Now, in the appendix on page 49, as counsel indicated, is a copy of the agreement that the appellant signed in this case, the behavior contract. It is true that the bulk of that contract is dedicated to issues like fighting at school, doing his work, and so on. However, point number 7 on the contract does indicate, I realize I am subject to random searches by school administration. As counsel pointed out, that's not exactly a model of clarity. But nevertheless, I think it does establish the appellant's consent, especially in light of the fact that he was not required to sign this. This wasn't a contract at the point of a gun or anything else. It was entirely voluntary, as indicated by the appellant's signature, the signature of his father, and the school administrator that were there at the time that the contract was signed. Whether it's overly broad is not really before this court. As Your Honor indicated, what's at issue for this court is whether it was overly broad in this case, and I'd submit to the court that that it is not, and that under any standard of review that the court wishes to adopt. Now, these are mixed questions of law and fact, but even under de novo review, I don't think that a search of the appellant's pockets and his backpack while he's at school is overly broad, given the consent that was obtained under the behavior contract. Again, this is not a carte blanche, as counsel indicated both in argument and in the brief. I think if the court views the facts as they are applied in this case, I think it's entirely reasonable that 3 months after signing the contract, when he's clearly still on a sort of probationary period with the school, that the contract is in effect and that he is subject to search by school administrators, who in fact are the ones that actually searched him in this case. I also want to point out that the contract itself, I submit to the court, is prima facie evidence of the voluntariness of that contract. There was never any testimony at any point in this case that the contract was somehow not voluntary. And under Bustamante, it is our burden to show that the consent was voluntarily obtained. And I submit to the court that the proof of that was established through the behavior contract. And that anything to the contrary, if the appellant wished to somehow contest the voluntariness of his agreement, that there had to be some evidence presented to do that. They chose not to present that evidence. The appellant did not testify at his contested hearing, as is his right. His father was present at the contested hearing, and reportedly his father was also present at the signing of the behavior contract. He was available to testify regarding any lack of voluntariness at the time the contract was signed. There was no evidence of that in the record, and so I'd submit to the court that based on what is in the record at this point, the appendix supports a finding of voluntariness.
So, please proceed. So, without exception, you're saying that the execution of the behavioral contract creates voluntariness and waives other protections?
Well, two things. Under the circumstances of this case, I would say that there's no evidence to suggest anything other than voluntariness.
No, I'm just talking about the last statement that you made. You said because there's this contract, it's that in and of itself is evidence of voluntary consent. So my question was, are you saying then that the contract creates voluntariness on its own and by doing so waives other constitutional protections that might otherwise be extended to the student?
I'm not sure I'm going that far. I think the issue before the court is the consent that was obtained through the contract voluntary? And so to a certain extent, I would say, yes, the signing of the contract is evidence of its voluntariness. Just as in criminal cases that we do here, the signing of the guilty plea agreement is evidence of the voluntariness of that.
And not always. We have a ton of cases that would say otherwise.
But exactly. But when that happens, there's evidence presented that the defendant in those cases somehow was not voluntarily or was coerced or so on. They present evidence to that effect. And that the agreement by itself, by the terms of the agreement, does establish what it purports to establish, which is that the consent was voluntarily obtained. In the absence of any other evidence, I don't think the court can make any other finding, especially under a deferential standard of review. As to whether that waives any other constitutional rights, again, I would look to the terms of the contract. The four corners of the contract discuss what the rights and responsibilities of the appellant were at that point. And again, most of them had to do with school-type issues, things like doing his homework and so on. But one of them had to do with his recognition of the administrator's right to search his person. And so I think that certainly was what was at issue here. I don't think that there's necessarily any, I'm not sure what other rights the court is referring to, but as to whether it waived any other rights, I'm not sure that it would.
Opposing counsel has distinguished the Oregon case Stevens, on which certainly you rely in part, and I would like to hear your response to her arguments, and based on the record in this case, not a larger issue, how does this case differ from what would be an unconstitutional requirement that to attend Clark High I had to sign a waiver of my constitutional rights to be free from search? I mean, what distinguishes this case from either of those two extremes?
A couple of things. I think the appellant's ability to attend adult ed on his own and not have to go to Legacy High School is one of the big ones. He had other options. He was in no way required to sign this contract to go to the school.
That and where in the record is the evidence of that?
That was in it's in the appendix on it's both during the, I don't have the exact page number, but it was during both the discussion with the hearing master as well as at the objection. Judge Boyd discussed that fact as well. That should be around, I think it was around 170 or so in the appendix, but I'd have to double check the appendix to give you a pinpoint site.
So there's not actual evidence other than a judicial officer's statement that, well, he could go to...
We didn't present any evidence from anyone in school administration, for example, to say that he had other options where he could go. But both Judge Henry and...
except in that they sort of took judicial notice, if you will.
Exactly, and that's exactly the type of fact that I think can be taken under judicial notice.
Okay, please continue. I didn't mean to interrupt your answer to my question.
The other issue that the court raised leads into counsel's second point. Now, our position is that the consent ends the matter in terms of the constitutionality of the search in this case. Nevertheless, if the court were to somehow find that it doesn't, there's the other sort of exception to the warrant requirement that, that we've raised in our brief, and that is the administrative search. Now, we discussed several cases, both in the brief and the appellant's brief, discussed things like Earls and Veronia and so on. And those cases dealt with students that had extracurricular activities or that sort of thing, having a diminished expectation of privacy. It's true as a general matter that students at a school, at a traditional school that are going to class because school is mandatory, do have an expectation of privacy in their persons and effects, of course, and so Fourth Amendment protections apply. However, the court distinguished between students that are there for that purpose and students that are there voluntarily or otherwise for other purposes. So, for example, and the extracurricular activities, I think the sports, I forget which particular sport it was at issue in Earls, the touchstone for the court was not what specifically the students were doing. It didn't quite matter exactly what activity they were there for or the touchstone was, as it always is with Fourth Amendment jurisprudence, is expectation of privacy, a reasonable expectation of privacy. And the court drew that line because the students in those cases, because they were there voluntarily, they weren't, it wasn't mandatory for them to go to school, because they were choosing to do extracurricular activities, they were subject to lessons, Fourth Amendment protections. And that's precisely what we have here. Now, even if the court were to find in this case that the consent was somehow not a waiver of his Fourth Amendment search in this particular case, nevertheless, I think that behavior contract does demonstrate that the appellant knew, and the appellant was on notice, that he was a non-traditional student and he had a lessened expectation of privacy in this case. Now, it's true that there was not a reasonable suspicion of the appellant committing any criminal conduct at the time the search was done. The search was purely random. And that's at the appendix, I think on page 84, where Mr. Olson discussed doing random searches of students that were on trial enrollment. Nevertheless, even if the court were to find that the consent was not a valid waiver through the behavior contract, the appellant was a non-traditional student with a diminished reasonable expectation of privacy due to that status, and that would justify the search as well. And I'd also note for the court here as well, we have a sort of interesting issue in terms of the record on this, because on page 169 of the appendix, Judge Voy indicated that he was upholding the search based on consent, but he was not convinced of the administrative justification for the search. Nevertheless, in his order, which is at the appendix on page 184, Judge Voy affirmed the findings of the hearing master, and hearing master Henry did in fact find that the search was justified both as to consent and as to the administrative search. And so we have this sort of split in the record where Judge Voy has said kind of two different things, one of which contradicts the other. And so I leave it to the court to decide where exactly the burden lies there, whether it's with Judge Voy's oral order at the time of the disposition or in his written order, which he did later. But I wanted to raise that issue for the court because it's frankly not clear to the litigants at this point whose burden of proof it is regarding the administrative search. But again, I suggest to the court under whatever standard the court wishes to apply that the administrative search would justify the search in this case, even if the consent search did not. Before I run out of time, I do want to talk about the proof established in this case, the second issue raised by the appellant. And again, before delving too deeply there, I want to highlight that the standard in this for this portion of the appellant's argument is clearly erroneous. For the appellant to prevail on the claim of insufficient proof, the court must find that the district court was clearly erroneous as to these issues of facts, because these are factual issues. Regarding the intent to sell, there were several issues several facts that we raised in the district court below. One of which was the $129 that was in the appellant's pocket when he was searched. He didn't really have an adequate explanation for that. The record indicates that what he told the court, what he told the officer was that he got it from hustling and playing dice games. And the officer was rightly skeptical of that, as was I, and as was the district court. In addition, in the briefs, the appellant makes the claim that he never made admissions regarding selling at school or anywhere else. And I wanted to correct the record on that briefly, because what the appellant said when asked about the drugs, he was asked, "Are you selling at school?" To which he denied. He said, "No, I'm not selling at school." And so the pitch I made in my closing argument before the hearing master was that suggests he was selling. He just wasn't selling at school. And so that, again, the hearing master considered that fact and weighed that, as well as the packaging of the baggies in this case, as evidence of the appellant's intent to sell. And for him to prevail on that issue, this court must find that it was clearly erroneous for any fact finder to have made that determination, and I don't think that can be done. I've got less than a minute left, but I also wanted to talk about the lack of a chemist. No court anywhere has ever required in a narcotics case that a chemist testimony be provided. That is not a requirement. There is no case. There is no authority for that. There was, now granted we get kind of lazy, that's how we typically produce that, but the appellant's brief on page 22 and several other places says that we are required to do that. We are not. That is not a requirement of any narcotics case, and no court has ever held that. I'm out of time. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. You have about a minute and a half.
Thank you. Just a brief response. I understand the court's position with regard to the states bringing up the new issue with regard to mootness and jurisdiction, but I would like to point out that the juvenile court has jurisdiction over children until the age of 21, and certainly Lamont has the right to request that this court overturn an unlawful adjudication and have that removed from his record, and that also goes to whether or not he has the timing. It has to do with...
My preference is that that matter be briefed separate.
Okay, thank you. Just to respond to some of the state's comments with regard to the voluntariness, I think that the court needs to look at the voluntariness and the scope at the time the contract was signed, rather than that it was just reasonable simply because this random search happened 3 months later. It is a question of law, so it's subject to de novo review. And when looking at the four corners of the document, the behavior contract, bless you, that it is insufficient in this case. I think the court can accept the notion that a child can waive his consent or waive his right to be free from unreasonable searches. And I think when you look at Oregon, the reasoning in there makes sense. But in those cases, the children at that school had a lessened degree of expectation of privacy based on the heightened level of security and structure. So that goes to that child's voluntariness as opposed to the situation here with Lamont signing up at Legacy High School, a completely regular school. I spit that.
Thank you very much. This matter will stand submitted and will be in recess.